From the Sky News Centre at 6. The Labour leader's denied there's bullying on a widespread scale in his party. Earlier, Jeremy Corbyn lost another MP, Ian Austin. He's quit because of what he describes as a culture of anti-Semitism and intolerance in the party. Mr Corbyn doesn't think that's the case.
There is no place for harshness, bullying or anything else in the party. And to tell you the truth, I don't believe it exists on a wide scale. Where there is bad behaviour, we deal with it. Where there is a problem, we deal with it.
The teenager who murdered six-year-old Alicia MacPhail on the Isle of Bute can now be named as Aaron Campbell after a judge allowed him to be identified. We previously couldn't do that because he's under 18 and that's against Scottish law. Our reporter James Matthews is outside Glasgow High Court.
Aaron Campbell is all across Facebook. Everybody in the Isle of Bute knows who he is. Everybody in Pomwant Young Offenders Institution, where he currently resides, knows who he is. So the argument was that it was essentially futile to try to keep his identity secret, given the public interest.
A 17-year-old boy has been detained for at least 19 years for the rape and murder of a teenage girl and dumping her body on a park bench in Wolverhampton. He was sentenced earlier after being convicted of killing Victoria Sokolova in December. Police in the US have charged the owner of the NFL Super Bowl winning New England Patriots with soliciting prostitution. They say they have video of Robert Kraft that was captured during a widespread crackdown on trafficking in Florida. He categorically denies any illegal activity. Jussie Smollett is to be removed from two Empire episodes after police allegations he faked a racist and homophobic attack. He denies any wrongdoing. And Chelsea say they'll appeal FIFA's decision to ban them from signing any new players in the next two transfer windows. It's after they were found guilty of breaking rules in relation to the transfer and registration of players under the age of 18. That's the latest.
BCFM. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, Lib Dem Councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins, Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. So, former teacher and education activist Christine Townsend from Save Our NHS, Mavis Zucchi, and retired international relations lecturer and author Ron Mandel. Quite a full house. After the 7 o'clock news, the US trade war is failing, hitting US high-tech manufacturers and farmers alike. So what's the point, Donald, in starting a war you can't win? Is that like Vietnam or Syria, maybe? Also, David Icke has his Australian visa refused, has to cancel a sellout tour after touring the country for decades without a problem. Back in the US, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro is a US rabbi, just one of many who have very different ideas about what we hear in the mass media and what the Jewish identity means and what the Israeli state and the Zionists are telling us. And his audience fills a US stadium. That's all in the second hour after the US Comcast owned news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend, around 14, nice and warm, sunny intervals with just maybe a little tiny bit of rain. Next week, highs at around 14, again, quite warm for this time of year, mainly sunny and light showers, though, towards the end of the week. Next weekend, the 2nd and 3rd of March, highs of 10 degrees Celsius and patchy rain. Much cooler, actually, next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining me to review this week's news, we've got some councillors. But first, before we do that, I'd like to have a chat to Mavis Zucci. Is that pronounced correctly, Mavis?
Yeah, that'll do.
Go on, you pronounce it properly, please. Since I've obviously got it a bit wrong.
Zucci.
From Protect Our NHS. So what is Protect Our NHS here in Bristol?
Protect Our NHS is a local Bristol campaign group which spends its time campaigning about what's happening to the NHS in terms of underfunding and privatisation and cuts, and also links up with other groups around the country that are coordinated nationally to try and argue for a fully public, fully accountable, well-funded, decent NHS that we deserve.
Well, a lot of people say, not necessarily myself, but a lot of people say that what we're getting is a lot of better value for money. Now parts of the NHS are being auctioned off to private businesses, that they can do things a lot cheaper than the state can.
Well, I think that's misinformation, really, that the government certainly would choose people to want to think that. But the reality is that the kind of privatisation and commercialisation of the whole of the NHS over the last 10 years, but prior to that as well, has actually been a hugely costly and very damaging kind of enterprise. So we can estimate that the cost of actually monitoring and procuring and commissioning private companies to run the NHS services is somewhere between £5 and £10 billion a year. There's an enormous army of staff who have to be employed to do that. And there's no evidence that people get better treatment through private companies than they do on the NHS.
Oh, but it's cheaper, isn't that the idea, that the commercial companies do these things cheaper?
Well, the commercial companies can only do it cheaper if they cut their costs in some way, and the way that they cut their costs will be through the terms and conditions of staff and through the quality and standards of care.
But it's also the fact that the National Health Service is one of, if not the cheapest healthcare systems in the world, and as soon as you start bringing in commercial companies, then there's a whole bunch of shareholders and fat cat bosses that want to take profit out of people who are getting ill.
Absolutely. Private companies are not accountable to the NHS, they're not accountable to the public, they're only accountable to their shareholders. So you're absolutely correct about that. And the reason that our NHS is one of the cheapest is because we actually devote the lowest proportion of our GDP to it compared with many other European countries. So it's amazing.
Is that why
we're
not so healthy as those European countries?
No, we have a number of health crises that are not the fault of the NHS. They're public health crises that have been in the making for a long time, and they're actually exacerbated by the austerity policies that we've been living under for the last 10 years.
So look, in a nutshell, just bring us up to date on what's happening locally and nationally with this NHS privatisation, because it is a slow privatisation. You can see, you know, what you do is you slowly, they did the same with the post office, so they slowly, Royal Mail, you know, bits of it then first get auctioned off to private companies, and then the whole thing eventually is likely to become privatised. So what's the state of play right now, Mavis?
Well, the state of play right now is that about 8% of the NHS budget or of clinical contracts are going to private companies. But if you added in the non-clinical work, the cleaning, the portering, the support services, all kinds of additional non-clinical services have been outsourced and privatised. It's a much, much bigger figure than that. And here in Bristol, we're actually facing an enormous recommissioning of all of the adult community health services, which will be coming up for contracting out.
But what is an adult community health service?
Well, it includes things like physiotherapy, community health services, district nurses, all sorts of things that you wouldn't necessarily kind of think of. But it adds up to a contract of £1.1 billion over the next 10 years. So this is a huge contract for services in Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloss, all now, going out to tender.
How do we know that someone is not going to underbid for that contract and then halfway through say, oh, well, sorry, I'm pulling out?
We don't. We can't guarantee that. With the NHS, there is no pulling out. The NHS has to deliver and has to stay with the service. But there are many examples of private contracts where the contractors have pulled out to disastrous effect. We know about Carillion. We also know about Stirkel, Hinchinbrook Hospital. There are all kinds of examples. And the NHS then has to pick up the pieces because it doesn't walk away from the public.
So, okay, just to wrap up, Mavis, how do people follow what's going on? What's the best way to keep track of what's happening in the city and nationally with the NHS privatisation?
Well, people can look on our Facebook page, which is Protect Our NHS Bristol. People can go on the Clinical Commissioning Group website. That is the body which is our local NHS, if you like. So those are the local NHS chiefs who are making these decisions. There's a website that people can go on and they can find out what's happening. There's going to be an interesting article in the Cable coming up about one of our campaigns around treatments that are being restricted that people may well be unaware of until they get into the doctor's surgery and ask if they can have a hernia or a hip op and be told, oh no, those are really now, you know, restricted, you may have to pay or go without. So those are some of the sources that
these
people
CCGs,
can follow.
Are they open to the public? Can you just go along? And do you go along and have a look and see what they get up to?
Yeah.
What are they like? What do they do? They're actually just sort of commissioning services for our local NHS, are they?
They are. They're big meetings. There are some meetings that are open to the public. They're not public meetings, but you can attend. You can ask questions if you prepare yourself in advance. There's a sort of Q&A time. A lot of it is then held in private because it's confidential, commercially confidential often. They're made up of health managers, GPs, but mainly health managers who actually run these services.
Okay, just remind us again, where do we find you? Online, I imagine, is the easiest place, or
online,
maybe even in
yeah.
the flesh, you never know.
Yeah, yeah, you can find us on Facebook, but we also we have a fortnightly meeting. The first and third Tuesday of every month, we meet at the Unite offices in Bristol, Central Bristol, Tony Benn House. And that's an open meeting, and we welcome anybody to come along and get involved in our stalls, in our campaigning work, in our letter writing, whatever it is we're doing. We're really glad to have anybody get involved.
Okay, Mavis Suchi, thanks ever so much from Protect Our
NHS. Thanks for having us on. That's
for coming along. I'll come to you, I think, on this one, Ron, because it was your suggestion that we got Mavis along. What is the point in what Protect Our NHS is doing in your mind?
Well, I think it's trying to remind people that we have still a world-class health service which needs defending. As an American, I can tell you that there are at least 30 million American citizens who don't have health insurance. We don't have a public-funded healthcare system in the United States. In my personal experience, 30-some years ago, I ran up a bill of $16,000 because I did not have healthcare insurance. In this country, I don't have to worry about treatment. I would never be turned away from any hospital if I went in with an illness that needed treatment. So I think we have an NHS which is based on altruism, cooperation, and I think we need to defend it.
It was something that was came out of the Second World War, wasn't it? I suppose people were also thinking around that time, if there's a burning building, you don't want to be having to rummage through someone's pockets to check their health insurance before you put them in an ambulance and get them treated.
That's exactly right. And it also was the NHS was created at a time when Britain was heavily in debt, much more so than it is today. So it's very interesting. The Labour government did not cry, we need austerity, we there's no alternative. They basically build the welfare state. And I think the NHS is the bedrock institution of that state, and we need to defend it.
In the States, what happens if you run out of money? You're saying you ran up some debts.
I can tell you my own story. I mean, a personal story. I was a PhD student at the time. I had no health insurance. I had severe abdominal pain. I checked into a hospital, and the first thing they asked me is I had health insurance. And I said, no. They started to examine me, and they said, well, we'll have to ship you from this hospital to another hospital. And the other hospital they were going to ship me to had a terrible reputation, and I said, if you ship me there, you might as well ship me to the morgue. And the nurses and the doctors started to laugh. But they didn't treat me there. They sent me to another hospital, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise.
Because this is a third hospital, yeah.
The third hospital, because the bedside care by nurses was first rate. And then the social worker who came by to see me after I had my operation said to me, how are you going to pay? And I said, I'm going to have to declare bankruptcy. And they went livid. You know, they said, what? You're going to declare bankruptcy? They found every possible grant I might be eligible for to apply. All they were concerned about was their money. They were not concerned about my state of being.
Well, they were, because they had actually got you back to a good state of health by then.
Yes, they did, but the social worker did not ask me how I was doing, you know, my frame of mind was, you know, how I was coping with the long stay in the hospital. I was in the hospital for 5 weeks. And to give you the straw that broke the camel's back from my perspective, I come out of the operation theater, and the first thing I see besides the nurse is a bill pinned to my dressing gown, a bill from the anesthesiologist. Where did he think I was going to go? He didn't even come to see me at my bedside and see how I was recovering from anesthesia. All he was concerned with was about his money. That, to me, is the epitome of private health care.
I mean, surely in an age of austerity, we just can't afford to pay for the NHS anymore.
Oh, of course we can. You know, we have tax reform. We have a progressive tax system in place. We could pay for it. If we crack down on tax avoidance and tax evasion, we could generate £160 billion of revenue, which could be used to adequately fund the NHS.
Mike Davis, you're a Labour councillor. What do you make of what we've just heard? And are we going to see a privatisation? What do you think? What word would you use to describe what's happening to the NHS at the moment?
Well, I think it is a privatisation by stealth. The Labour Party, the Labour government that was elected in 1945, set up the NHS. And I think it's best when the NHS is run on those original principles the NHS was founded on. I think the NHS is only safe in the hands of a Labour government, and I think the record of the Conservative Party in running the NHS is a record of failure. We've seen with waiting times going up, we've seen with the deficits that CCGs have run into. Things are getting worse in the NHS. Private companies are moving in more. And I think we have to elect a Labour government to get the NHS back on track.
Gary, some of this was done during the coalition government when you were in coalition with the Tories, wasn't it?
Well, in actual fact, the privatisation recent was started under Gordon Brown, and that's the largest amount that was actually done. I'm extremely sceptical about privatisation. It doesn't mean to say that it's never the right solution, because sometimes it does work. Having been responsible for services within the council, we need to keep in-house the high skills. We need to keep in place people who've got to make decisions. But you can sometimes give up the very routine
things. Be specific. What are you talking about? Where has it been a great roaring success?
Well, I can tell you, in terms of grounds maintenance for the council, simple explanation, the high-skilled gardeners had to be in-house council employees. The people who are doing the routine cutting of the grass so many times a year, they were privately procured, and that was the most efficient way to do it. I'm not saying within the NHS that it's been successful. The only time that you can actually make a privatisation cost effective is if you've got repeat simple operations that have got to be done. That's the only time it can actually happen.
Now,
and where there's got to be judgment and commitment to public service, privatisation's not going to work.
Richard Branson's organising a wonderful concert over in Venezuela. I think he's actually on the border, isn't he? I mean, he's also looking at taking over a load of what Mavis is just talking about, our National Health Service here in this region. Do you think he'd make a good person to run it? I mean, did you go on his trains? Have you been on his planes? And is he the right person to be holding our lives in his hands?
I'm not a fan.
Okay, we'll leave it. We'll leave it at that. Look, we're going to be talking, obviously, about this new independent group of Labour MPs, and they've got Tories as well now, a little while. But before that, I think a more important story this week is the passing of Labour MP Paul Flynn from Newport. And he's actually a fascinating guy. We've had him, we did an hour on this show with him. And he managed to do something which I don't think I've seen any other MP manage to do, which was to be totally independent-minded, but yet still be a team player for the Labour Party. So
he had a wonderful quote when he was talking about New Labour, which he wasn't a great fan of, and he said, "The trouble about New Labour is that the future's always the same. It's the past they keep changing."
Interesting. Well, we're going to be going, we're looking at the past a little bit here. But here's Paul speaking in 2016 to the entire Labour Party conference. And, yeah, back in 2016.
Good to be back, conference. I last spoke in 1981, and I'm here today as a grateful recipient of Jeremy's job creation schemes for geriatrics. Is it all over? Is that last 12 months gone? Is that last 12 months when we've been locked in a gap year of negativity, of pessimism, of hopelessness by many in our party?
He's talking about the leadership challenge to Jeremy Corbyn by Owen Smith.
To see who can be the most pessimistic about our future and our prospects. We've got to end that. It's time now to give unity a chance. What we should do is take all the bile and the hatred together, put it in a box, bury it deep underground, put 6 feet of concrete on top, and then put a sign saying, "Never shall the last 12 months be unearthed from its dishonoured grave." We're going forward, comrades, to government. Len McCluskey made a great speech for unity yesterday, but there's one phrase in it, the one that he stole from Shakespeare, that I must disagree with, because he did say that some should depart the field. No, no, no. The Tories have already got their A-team on the field, and we've got some of our best people sitting there on the subs bench. You don't score goals from the subs bench. We need them all back. Many resigned in that awful period 3 months ago. Some resigned. They all did for honourable reasons. It took courage for many of them to resign. It's going to take greater courage for many of them to come back. And we must make it possible for them to return with dignity and respect. The trouble with unity is that it's not sexy. The press, the media aren't interested in it. They're interested in rows, they're interested in division, they're interested in conflict. But they don't notice the brilliant year we've had. Magnificent election results. Instead of the polls, look what happens when real people use real votes in real elections. Marvellous results in all the mayoral elections, in all the by-elections. In Wales, we gained 3 parliamentary seats that we lost a year ago. There have been successes too in the Commons, working with our comrades in the Lords. We've done a great deal to force U-turns on the government, on the personal independence payments, on Sunday training laws, selling prison contracts to Saudi Arabia. All those things have been achieved in opposition, working intelligently with others in the House of Commons.
So that's the former Labour MP, Paul Flynn, who died last week. Mike, I mean, it's fascinating to hear him say, talking about people should not be leaving, they should come back, and that you don't score any goals from the subs bench. Now, that seems almost as if it was ringing in the background on Monday when we had 7 Labour MPs who decided that they were going to leave the party and form their own independent group.
Yes, I mean, Tuesday was obviously a very sad day for the Labour Party. with Paul Flynn passing. He was a very inspiring parliamentarian, a committed socialist, dutiful MP, principled person, you know, and a principled advocate of drug law reform, republicanism, and other issues. So, yeah, I think a lot of what he said in that speech you just played was absolutely true and very prescient as well.
Ron, what do you think about people like this? Is it still possible to be independent-minded while still being a team player in a big political party like Labour?
I don't think there's any contradiction. I think Paul Flynn was quite right. I think he was saying that he's repeating what most people in the Labour Party often give lip service to. That's a broad church. The Labour Party has always been a mixture of political perspectives. It's unfortunate that the seven MPs who left the Labour Party have not heeded his advice. They're turning their back not only on the Labour Party, but on their constituents. And I think I agree.
They would say they're doing it out of principle.
They would say they're doing it out of principle, but if that is the case, I think John McDonnell is quite right. They should face the electorate. They should go through a by-election and test whether or not their principles will stand up to the electorate.
Do you think they would?
I don't think they will, because they would probably realize that they would be defeated.
One does wonder if maybe some of them had an inkling, Mike, that they may have either been deselected or lose at the next general election anyway.
Well, some of those MPs, I think that may have been true. I think it's very regrettable that Luciana Berger, the MP for Liverpool Wavertree, felt like she was forced out of the party. I think some of the abuse she got was completely unacceptable. Some of the others in that group, you know, well, I think, you know, they were upset with the direction of the Labour Party, as in it becoming a more unapologetically socialist party.
I mean, do you
party.
Think any of them ever supported Jeremy Corbyn being leader? Some of them certainly didn't seem to.
Well, I mean, a lot of them, they stood on that 2017 manifesto, and many of them had majorities massively increased, doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and now it seems to be the case that they actually never agreed with that manifesto, and they want to sabotage the prospect of a truly left-wing socialist government.
So, Gary, as a Lib Dem, are you happy to see this going on in the Labour Party?
Well, I think it's an illustration, actually, of the problem in British politics at the moment, in that both the Labour and Conservative Party rely for a large amount of their support on hatred of the party opposite rather than actually love for the party the people are actually joining. It wasn't just these MPs who thoroughly dislike Corbyn and what he actually stands for. I think, wasn't it 170 passed a motion of no confidence in him? So clearly there's not a lot of love lost there.
Anyway.
And actually, with regard to these people having a moral obligation to face the electorate, there have been 69 cases of MPs leaving parties since the World War II in all different directions. Four of them have resulted in by-elections, so there isn't any precedent for that, and it's not going to happen. And the Labour leadership who are demanding that are just talking complete hogwash.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a certain principle involved. If you think that you can still get elected under that platform, but you've been elected under a Labour platform, and then you're resigning, and you're saying, I'm going to have my own platform now, knowing that you wouldn't get elected under it.
Well, I don't know. I think the thing is that these people say that they're still the people that they were. They're entitled, you know, to stay in their present positions if they want to. We'll see what happens when the next elections come up.
Okay, well, let's go.
And all sorts of things could happen between now and then.
They certainly could.
A huge amount of things could happen.
Yes, even in a month's time, a lot could happen. But let's go back anyway to the beginning of the week to hear from Luciana Berger, who was the first in the line of seven MPs to give her resignation speech, and it didn't start too well, even just that very first line.
My name is Luciana Berger, and I am the Labour and I am the Member of Parliament for Liverpool Wavertree. This morning, we have all now resigned from the Labour Party. This has been a very difficult, painful, but necessary decision. We represent different parts of the country. We are of different backgrounds. We were born of different generations, but we all share the same values. From today, we will all sit in Parliament as a new independent group of MPs. For my part, I have become embarrassed and ashamed to remain in the Labour Party. I have not changed. The core values of equality for all, opportunity for all, anti-racism against all, and social justice, the values which I hold really dear and which led me to join the Labour Party as a student almost 20 years ago, remain who I am. And yet these values have been consistently and constantly violated, undermined and attacked, as the Labour Party today refuses to put my constituents and our country before party interest.
So that's Luciana Berger there, starting the sort of cavalcade of people leaving the Labour Party this week. Ron, one of the main things she cited was anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. As a Jewish person yourself, is this something you recognise as a valid reason to leave? And how real is that anti-Semitism?
Well, she did not mention anti-Semitism by name in the clip that you just we were just listening to. I think anti-Semitism is always a concern of whether or not you're Jewish or not, because she's quite right. The Labour Party stands on the principles of equality and social justice. I don't know from – I'm not in her shoes. I can't speak for her in terms of what she's experienced. Whatever abuse has been sent her way is unjustifiable. It's indefensible. But I think it's the timing of the resignation – or leaving the Labour Party, which I think is very interesting, because the Labour Party panel, which was hearing cases referred to it to investigate alleged anti-Semitism, and I have to emphasize alleged, because very often people repeat the charge anti-Semitism as if it's a fact. The panel released statistics which actually have wrong-footed the criticism of the critics of the Labour Party for not taking anti-Semitism seriously. And they basically have said almost 50% of the alleged incidents of anti-Semitism have been committed by people who are not members of the Labour Party, all right? They also released statistics that have shown that at least 30 people have been expelled from the Labour Party for documented anti-Semitism, and others basically are resigning from the Labour Party even before going through the investigation process. So the Labour Party is taking seriously the allegations of anti-Semitism. It's not as if the Labour Party's turned its back on it. Now, I'm not a member of the Labour Party. I have to make that very clear. So I have no vested interest in defending Jeremy Corbyn or the Labour Party. But objectively, from what I know from the facts of the situation, I think anti-Semitism has been weaponized. It's been used constantly to undermine the credibility and the political agenda of the Corbyn leadership. And I think it's been used in a way that actually demeans and devalues authentic anti-Semitism.
Well, I noticed many of the people that resigned this week are members of Labour Friends of Israel. But I mean, do you think this has got anything to do with Jeremy Corbyn's opposition in many ways to Likud in Israel and his support for Palestinians, Ron?
Well, he's been a constant critic of Israeli policies and practices. And more importantly, a defender of Palestinian human rights. And I think that's very critical. And I think there's been, unfortunately, a conflation with anti-Zionism, with anti-Semitism. Any criticism of Israel has been equated with anti-Semitism. So I think Corbyn has to be credited at least trying to introduce the possibility of looking at Israel's practices in a way that separates the Jewish identity of people who support Israel from the fact of the matter with what Israel is doing in the name of Jewish population.
Okay, let's have a listen to another one of the people who resigned, and that's Sir Chris Leslie, MP.
My name is Chris Leslie. I'm the Member of Parliament for Nottingham East. The evidence of Labour's betrayal on Europe is now visible for all to see. Offering to actually enable this government's Brexit, constantly holding back from allowing the public a final say, conference policy has been cast aside, no guaranteed full participation in the single market anymore, no exact same benefits, no movement towards a people's vote. Choosing to stand by while our constituents' lives and future opportunities are hurt by Brexit is a fundamental violation of Labour's traditional values. But our differences go far deeper than Brexit. The past 3 years have confirmed how irresponsible it would be to allow this leader of the opposition to take the office of Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Many people still in the Labour Party will privately admit this to be true, but we owe it to our constituents now to say it publicly and honestly. The pursuit of policies that would threaten our national security through hostility to NATO, the refusal to act when needed to help those facing humanitarian distress, preferring to believe states hostile to our country rather than believing our police and security services, these are all rooted in the Labour leadership's obsession with a narrow, outdated ideology. They're hostile to business, large and small. They make impossible promises which everybody knows in their hearts couldn't be kept without putting the economy at risk. And they constantly pit one part of society against another, because to them the world divides between oppressor and oppressed, class enemies, when in truth the modern world is more complicated than this. And then, as Luciana was saying, there is an appalling culture. Intolerance, closing down of debate, abuse and hatred online, as you're seeing this morning, and offline in party meetings, and anti-Semitism. So we have no choice but to say collectively, enough is enough.
There's quite a lot in that speech, Mike. He's saying, talking about Russia. I mean, he didn't mention Russia by name, but he's saying that the Labour leadership seem to want to believe other people, not the police and MI5. He's also saying that we should not be questioning any kind of acts or membership of NATO, and that many of the promises that the Labour leadership right now are making are impossible to fulfill.
Well, I don't agree with anything he said in that speech. I think he's the one with an outdated ideology. In an interview after that, he said that he opposes renationalisation of the railways, water and so on, which a massive majority of the public support. He opposes increasing the top rate of tax to 50%, which a massive majority of the public support, and doesn't agree with abolishing tuition fees, which a big majority of the public support. I mean, you know, I just think that it's, you know, he talked about Europe. The Labour policy hasn't changed since the 2017 manifesto, which he stood on, which said that Labour would respect the result of the referendum, that we would have a close relationship with the single market, that we'd argue for a customs union. He stood on that manifesto, and now he's ripping it up. He got elected on that manifesto. He massively increased his majority on that manifesto, and now he wants to sabotage Labour's chances of getting into government.
Fascinating. Anyway, also, midday, after that had happened, Angela Smith appeared on the TV, and she appeared to many people have said was began to use a racist, potentially racist expression, talking about dark tinge, I think it was, wasn't it? So yeah. Let's have a little listen to that now, which was just literally a few hours after this new group's announced. This was a little bit of a boo-boo.
A white working class woman finds life hard enough. A BME working class woman, and this is the gender aspect, will find it even harder. But it's not just about colour. I mean, you know, the recent history of the party I've just left suggests that it's not just about being black or a funny, you know, different from the BME community, but the Jewish community equally. The Jewish community equally suffers the same kind of cultural alienation.
I'm not saying it's...
So, sorry, it wasn't dark. It was a funny tinge. Now, this is a little bit of a bit of a racial stereotype she's coming up with there. But then she's apparently left the Labour Party based on the fact that it's not taking equality seriously enough.
Yes, it's astonishing. I mean, it's after leaving a party, apparently, because of racism, she comes out with one of the most racist things I've ever heard an MP say.
Ron, what do you make of this anyway? Is it a slip of the tongue, Matt?
Well, I think I want to respond to the two clips we just heard. The first one, the remarks could have been written by a Tory speechwriter. It was a frontal attack against everything that the Labour Party stands for based on the manifesto and all Labour Party policy. So I don't know how he could have remained a Labour Party MP for all these years if that's the way he thought. The second one could have been a slip of tongue, but it actually indicates again how hollow the allegations of racism, of intolerance, and the betrayal of Labour Party principles are. You have consistently, these MPs have been critical of Jeremy Corbyn ever since he was elected party leader. They've been trying to chip away at his credibility.
Saying he's a threat to national security when they've been entitled to that view.
But they're repeating the Daily Mail and the Sun allegations. And Jeremy Corbyn was a very principled chair of the Stop the War Coalition. He's always stood for peaceful solutions to conflicts. He's not a warmonger. He doesn't believe in basically saber-rattling. And I think his approach to foreign policy has been very rational.
Gary, do you think Corbyn is a threat to national security? We did have, I think it's a general or someone a couple of years ago say when he was first elected that they wouldn't be able to trust him with state secrets.
Well, and he wouldn't be the first Labour leader that's been in that position. I understand that Harold Wilson, who was not exactly far left, was treated with a great deal of caution by people in the in power.
In fact, there are a couple of very good books about how MI5 managed to get Harold Wilson to resign back in 1976 by using bullying and dirty tricks, which makes you wonder who's really running things. But anyway,
I think, in actual fact, the most damaging thing for the Labour Party is not the fallouts over policy, because those will happen everywhere, particularly where you're trying to keep together such a broad range of people that they just don't agree. We know that, and that applies to the Conservative Party and the Labour Party.
Do you think he should be more disciplined with his MPs, that he should be a little bit more, because he seems to be very much more loose rein than, say, the Tories are with their MPs?
Well, that's up to them, the way that they run their parties. I'm not going to comment on that, but I would much rather listen to somebody like Tom Watson, who actually does recognise that there is, deputy leader of the Labour Party, who does recognise that there are serious problems here with behaviour and the way that people are actually doing things. And that's actually the most damaging thing that's actually happening to the Labour Party at the moment, not the disagreements over individual policy, important though Brexit is at the moment.
Now, we had another interesting incident this week, which was the former leader of Liverpool City Council, Derek Hatton, being readmitted to the Labour Party and literally within hours then being suspended. So,
I love the quote from the Guardian, lady journalist from the Guardian, who actually said that listening to Luciana Berger was like something to do with sexual pleasure, but then you got a dose of gonorrhea from Derek Hatton being readmitted.
So he's lovely, Gary. Thank you. He was suspended for a tweet which was discovered. I mean, I don't know. Someone must have some sort of supercomputer somewhere that's trawling the entire internet from tweets from 10 years ago. As soon as somebody gets into any sort of position, in order to find out anything that they might have said that could be used to get rid of them. And this tweet is from the Liverpool Echo website, which isn't making it incredibly easy for me to read this, but it says this is a Derek Hatton tweet from a few years ago saying this is, I think it was during an Israeli bombardment of Gaza. He said, "Jewish people with any sense of humanity need to start speaking out publicly against the ruthless murdering being carried out by Israel." I'll ask both you, Mike, and you, Ron. Is that an anti-Semitic? Give you a time to think about what you're going to say on that one. Well, we'll hear a little bit from Derek Hatton now and go back to when he was running Liverpool City Council. And, of course, it was Neil Kinnock, the Labour leader at the time, that suspended him and many other members of Militant from the party.
The Labour Party in Liverpool, as a campaigning, fighting party against Liberal policies, against Tory policies, against unemployment, will be such a fighting, campaigning party that it will actually take evidence and examples from the Liverpool Labour Party to take around the rest of the country, to other district Labour parties in the rest of the country, to show how it really should be done.
Militant began in Liverpool. Its supporters insist their major aim is to sell their newspaper and to spread their Trotskyist views. And this they've sought to do through the Labour Party since the late 60s. Taking over the party and using it for revolutionary socialism is what their critics allege is the ultimate intention.
Ron, what do you make of this? I mean, I don't know how much you know about Militant back in the 1980s, but it was very strong in Liverpool and potentially was a movement which had grown to take over other, of course this is under Thatcher government, and could have grown to maybe take over other cities and start running them like London had been run by Ken Livingstone in the 80s. Mm-hmm. As a real competition to central government. And they were talking about, they were doing things like failing to balance the budget, that sort of thing.
Well, I think my recollection is the Labour Party saw the Militant tendency as an interest group which was basically not loyal to the Labour Party and basically had its own political agenda. I don't know enough about Labour Party politics at that time to comment any further than that, but I want to comment on the previous quote that you cited. I think he was probably referring to the bombing campaign against Gaza in 2014. I attended three demonstrations, and the last one I marched with a delegation, because I am a member of Jews for Justice for Palestinians. And the number of people who came up to me and shook my hand, these were people, some were Arabs, some were Muslims. People basically said, yes, it's not a question about religion, it's a question about inhumanity and injustice and brutality. So I don't think there's anything anti-Semitic about his comment. I thought all those people basically denouncing Israeli barbaric policies were calling a spade. It had nothing to do with racism or religion.
I don't think he should have tweeted that. I don't think it's right to imply that Jewish people as a whole should apologize for the actions of the Israeli government. So I think it's fair enough that the party suspended him.
So he may be back. So he's only suspended. He may come bouncing back, Derek. We shall see. I mean, who knows if he'll still be such a firebrand as a considerably older chap. Anyway, so what's go on, Gary?
Well, I mean, it's not just the things he's been suspended for. You could go back. You wouldn't need to do deep searching to find out impossible, appalling things that Derek Hatton has said against all sorts of people, and quite frankly, appalling. And it's quite interesting, actually. The Tories have got their own version of Militant now. It's called the ERG, isn't it? You know? And basically, it's an exact mirror. The two are exactly the same, and they show the weaknesses of the present political structures that we've got.
Anyway, back in the real world, there is been an announcement about the car plant in Swindon this week as well, which is pretty shocking to think that they're just going to stop making cars there.
Angela Eagle.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2017, during the election, we learned what the Prime Minister's definition of strong and stable was. As our automotive industry disintegrates before our eyes, as investment is put on hold, as growth slows, are we now learning what the Prime Minister's definition of smooth and orderly Brexit is?
Prime Minister!
To the Honourable Lady, as I say to every member this House, there will come a further point in this chamber when every member...
Oh, I don't know what happened to poor Theresa May. She didn't make much of a... Didn't make much of a good reply there. Apologies for that. But anyway, this is a pretty shocking thing, wrong, isn't it? The idea that just as it comes up to Brexit, Honda were saying, to begin with, they were saying, well, we're going to be manufacturing new cars potentially in Britain. And now it looks like they're pulling out. But to be fair, they're also pulling out of Turkey too.
Well, we all know that businesses, what they want is certainty, predictability. And if they lose confidence in a government's ability basically to create the conditions that are conducive for a healthy business, they will make a business decision. So I'm not surprised. I mean, more and more businesses are very nervous about Brexit, the consequences of Brexit, the access to markets, the access to raw materials, access to supply lines. So this does not come as a shock to me. It might come as a shock to people in Swindon, but it's quite predictable.
Also, Mike, a lot of people will be pointing the finger saying, well, these decisions are made outside the UK now. If you go back 30, 40 years, there was such a thing as a British car industry. I'd imagine in Swindon too. In fact, I think they used to make car bodies in Swindon, didn't they, for other parts of the country. We're now in a situation where surely this is just the tip of the iceberg. Lots of other businesses that aren't actually based in Britain anymore, the little industry that we've got left, these decisions are being made abroad.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it goes back to the Tory government of the 80s destroying Britain's manufacturing base, and I think a Labour government would do a lot to improve that situation.
Okay, where would a Labour government get the money from? From the magic money tree?
I think the Conservatives and the right-wing media have created a narrative that government investment is a bad thing. I think government investment is a good thing. So, you know, people talk about debt and borrowing. You know, that's actually investment, and that helps the economy.
Gary, is it feasible to rebuild any of these industries, do you think, after Brexit?
Well, just to correct you, Mike, I'm not a fan of Margaret Thatcher, but back in the 80s, it was her efforts that actually dragged the Japanese car manufacturers across to the UK, and she was able to bring them across because there were tariffs against things imported from Japan, but we then were tariff-free with the rest of Europe, and we were regarded as a safe place to do business. We're no longer regarded as a safe place to do business. The Tory party have lost all credibility as a party who support business and can look after business. With what's happened over the last two or three years, it's been an absolute shambles. And basically, if you look at the situation with the Japanese car makers, Japan did a deal with the EU, which was ratified not that long ago, which removed tariffs. Now we're proposing to put in a barrier that will increase tariffs. What is the firm going to do? They're bound to do their manufacturing in Japan.
So, Mike, will there be any investment? I mean, there's going to be an empty factory in Swindon very soon. Is there actually going to be any kind of investment post-Brexit, assuming it happens in a month or so's time?
Well, as Ron said, businesses obviously want certainty, and we're however many days away from Brexit and no deal's still on the table. I think the Tory Brexit, the way they've run things, has had a massive cost to the economy. Labour will have a different kind of Brexit with the close single market relationship and the customs union, which businesses want. So the Labour form of Brexit will be much better for our manufacturing industry and economy in general.
No form of Brexit is good for business, and the majority of people actually recognise that. I agree that a closer tie would reduce the damage, but it wouldn't eliminate it.
Mervyn King, former governor of the Bank of England, would disagree. He was the guy Gordon Brown appointed. He said, actually, he thinks there will be very little difference after in jobs and the economy.
There's
generally
already been a very significant difference. We've had a massive devaluation of the pound, which has hit all of us, although not everyone's noticed straight away, apart from when they take holidays on the continent.
But that means it's easier to sell things, surely?
Well, not abroad. Apparently not. And a lot of companies have moved their head office out of the UK onto the continent.
Anyway,
already.
Let's just move on, talk a bit about Stoke Lodge and Cotton School and the problems down there, because this is causing an enormous amount of anguish for thousands of people living around there who use that piece of land. Gary, was this one of the parks that you planned to sell off all those years ago?
I didn't plan to sell off any parks, as you well know. And in actual fact, when I was in charge of the Environment Department, we acquired more land for parks than any other administrator has ever done in Bristol's history, and we actually invested in our parks.
What do you make about what's happened with Cotton School now? Because the locals are saying you're not even using this land. Ofsted have said you don't need to fence this off. What's this fence all about? We use this piece of land. It's our only local piece of open space.
And yeah,
obviously that's a terrible detriment to the people that live there.
It never was a park, but basically was used by a lot of people, and I think the fencing off and the way that it's actually being done is unnecessary.
Well, what was it?
Well, it was open land. It wasn't a designated park.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you make of the way the council's dealt with this?
Incompetent.
Why?
Because they haven't faced up to the reality of the situation, where you've got two opposing groups, both of whom have difficulties with their case. I mean, we know that the school...
Is it possible to share a piece of land like that?
Yes.
Mike?
Well, as I mentioned last week on your show, there's a judicial review coming up, so the council's told us to be careful about what we say about this, and particularly me as I sit on the planning committee.
Gary, do you think there's any aspect to this? Would it be different if the Cotton School was under local authority control?
Yes.
How would it be different?
Well, one of the problems with the academy system is that they grab the land and basically... The local authority forced to hand it across. Now, you know, there are much, and it does lead not just with playing fields, but also with other facilities, that there's a lack of sharing with the academies in terms of facilities, and that's a problem.
The land grabbers. Anyway, we have an interview coming up on Dialect, not this coming week, but the week after, with the author of a book called The New Enclosures, which is all about the sale of public land. Time now for the US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our guests. That's Lib Dem Councillor Noel, Gary Hopkins, Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis.
Thank you.
And we'll be hearing former teacher and education activist Christine Townsend and Ron Mandel after the news too.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.